David Runciman, Professor of Politics at Cambridge University, host of the popular podcast Talking Politics, and for many a year the principal reason I subscribed to the London Review of Books. His new book is called Where Power Stops, The Making and Unmaking of Presidents and Prime Ministers. It begins with LBJ, ends with Donald Trump, and in between we hear about Thatcher, Blair, Obama, and then some B-teamers. Let me read a few lines from David's intro. All the politicians I write about in this book had moments when they believed that dark forces were at work to prevent them getting their way. But only one has turned this belief into his governing philosophy, Donald Trump. David is in the BBC studio at Cambridge, and welcome back.
Pleasure to be back.
David, to understand your book, we have to talk about another monumental political biography that Robert Caro's immense work on Lyndon Johnson. Why do politicians of all kinds, except perhaps Trump, love reading this biography?
It's a good question, and I've been really struck by it because it seems to be almost universal, although then I was thinking about it, all the people who love it are men, so I think we have to bear that in mind. But I think what they love about it is partly that those volumes are a kind of love letter to politics, and not just the politics that we all see. So politicians love it because they feel like Caro's really got behind the scenes and is celebrating some of the dark arts as well, but still keeps a moral core. And then the other thing I think they like about it is because it's a story about Johnson, who was a pretty terrible man, monstrous and paranoid and cruel fairly often, but is redeemed by the presidency and is redeemed in the end by the great acts he achieved in the early years of his presidency. And I think all politicians who are aware they have a dark side also believe that there may be redemption at the end of their story too. And I think those two things make it compelling for politicians. And it's not just left or right. Clinton loved it. Obama loved it in this country. A lot of conservative politicians, including some of those responsible for Brexit, loved it too.
But David, you have a third reason, as told by Caro's Life of Johnson, that individual politics can make a difference. It's about the force of personality.
Yeah, that's right as well. So Johnson, that slightly monstrous personality, you can still see in his case that he was at various points, crucial points in American history, first in the United States Senate, but then crucially after the assassination of JFK, perhaps the only person who could have done what he did. That combination of his kind of politics and his kind of political drive, but also skill in manipulating people and institutions, it did make the crucial difference. And at times where sometimes it can feel in politics that impersonal forces or markets or even the public are driving it, for politicians to learn that the politician can make the difference is deeply consoling.
David, I well remember him as both the best and worst of politicians, of presidents, but you point out that people who follow the book, who use it as a text, that you reckon Caro has got LBJ wrong.
So I think he's drawn the wrong moral from the story. So I love those books too, I should say, and they are wonderful. They're like a kind of multi-level novel, and the range of characters is remarkable. I'd recommend them to anyone. But at the beginning of the fourth volume, the one about the presidency, Caro spells out what he says is his moral, which is he thinks when a politician gets to the top job, which is what my book is about, the ones who make it to the very top in the US and the UK, we discover who the person really is. There's some kind of core personality that maybe has been hidden, and it comes to the fore. And in Johnson's case, Caro says that was a man of compassion. And I argue in my book that it's probably the other way around. I don't think that ultimate power reveals the real person. I think the person reveals the nature of the power. And that Johnson, there wasn't a compassionate person buried in there. When he got to the top job, that same person we've seen all along, that ruthless man of power and of personal authority and sometimes of cruelty, he discovered compassion was his weapon, that he could use it to forge his own identity. That
if so he could complete, fake compassion like a lover might fake orgasm.
Yeah, or like some politicians fake sincerity as well. I'm sure he could persuade himself, and maybe in parts of his soul there was a bit that sung with the tunes of compassion that he spoke, but he wasn't doing it for that reason. his motivation when he became president was to be seen to be a rightful president and not just the lucky inheritor of JFK's crown. And the way he worked out to do that was to do the things that JFK couldn't do, and that meant civil rights and great society, the compassionate program. But he did it not because he was a deeply feeling human being, because he wasn't. He did it because that was the way to exercise power. And it is, in the end, about power.
David, let's take a politician out of pretty much at random and apply your principles. Theresa May, if you please.
Yeah, so when she was Prime Minister, again, I think the same thing applied, that she'd seemed mysterious and she'd been a long-standing Home Secretary in this country, but no one really knew who she was. And on the great issue of the day, Brexit, no one really knew what she believed. She, in theory, was in favour of Remain, and then she became a Prime Minister who was committed to leave. And there was this feeling, like the Caro moral, that we would discover the real Theresa May, that this slightly opaque and actually slightly unemotional person would reveal her true core. And she never did. She was there for 3 years, and I think it's always a mistake to think you're going to find something that was hidden before. I think when she was Prime Minister, she was just like the person she'd been before. In my book, I take these stories back to the childhoods of some of these politicians. Personality is set long before you reach the top. That's who she was, the slightly opaque, slightly mysterious person. And what we discovered in her Prime Ministership is that that personality in this situation, this crisis of British politics, wasn't enough. She thought she could hedge her bets, and she thought she could just buy determination and doggedness get us over the line, and she couldn't, and now we've got another Johnson.
What about Blair and Clinton, both elected on, waves of optimism and promises of reform, and then doomed by war and sexual scandal?
Yeah, and or. I don't think Blair would be too happy to be coupled exactly in those terms. I think Blair is interesting.
David, there are plenty of rumours about Tony.
I know, but I don't think we're going to discuss them. I think with Blair, what's interesting is that a lot of people felt, in a way, they were betrayed by him, people who voted for him on that wave of optimism in 1997 and again in 2001, because they felt that they discovered the real Blair in 2002-03, the Iraq War and post-9/11, a politician who had been hidden emerged, a kind of neocon, a warrior, a believer in liberal interventionism that had been buried before. But actually, I don't think it was buried before. I think with Blair, the consistent personality that comes through is he was someone who was always looking for a kind of holistic solution. And in domestic politics, he was frustrated because domestic politics is frustrating and it's really hard to join all the dots. And then after 9/11, he was able to move to an arena of politics, international politics, where you intervene to make the world a better place. And it suited his personality, not because somehow something about him was hidden and revealed, but because the power of his office of Prime Minister allowed him to let that side of his personality to the fore. And the people who felt they were betrayed by him, if you trace his career, the evidence was there all along. It was the opportunity that was missing, and he got it. And Clinton, I think, similar-ish. I think he's a different kind of personality. I think Clinton was more the voracious, insatiable, and extremely intelligent politician who just, he didn't want to join it all up, I think, but he just wanted to do everything. And the politician who tries to do everything, tries to do too much, ends up caught.
Here's a quote: Clinton can do dispassion. He can do compassion. What he doesn't do is contrition. Not then, not now.
No. And I don't think actually he does deep self-knowledge. There were points in his presidency where people felt that it was a kind of group therapy that we were seeing being played out. But actually, when you look at his career, and the chapter in the book is based on the very intimate conversations he had with Taylor Branch, the journalist, in the White House, in real time, in the West Wing, as these events were unfolding and the tapes, the verbatim tapes are recounted, he's not into reflecting on his own either virtues or failings, neither virtues nor vices. He was always looking for the things outside himself that would somehow make it all feel okay for him. but he never ever got to the point where he thought something deep in himself needed correcting. And he's still like that now. He still won't admit his mistakes. He still won't admit his mistakes, whether it's with Lewinsky or whether it's the ways in which he, I think, has damaged his wife's prospects of becoming president. It's all about him, but he'll never admit that it is actually all about him.
He doesn't do contrition. Well, that's perfectly clear, but nor, I think, does Blair. But let's move on to Thatcher. Does she prove or disprove Kerr's argument about power revealing the true person, David?
So again, I think with her, when you trace the career, and in her case, there is actually another magnificent biography, and the third volume of it is being published this week in the UK, which is Charles Moore's biography of Margaret Thatcher. So that's a three-volume one, and it takes her story from her childhood. And I think we forget in some ways, it's such a remarkable story. It is as remarkable as Lyndon Johnson's The Boy from Nowhere. I mean, she was, in British political terms, particularly for the Tory party, which was, when she rose to the top of it, establishment rooted in a kind of aristocratic tradition. For the daughter, the grocer's daughter from Grantham, the middle of nowhere, the middle of England, to make it to the top, it's an incredible thing. But she seems to be, again, to me, not someone who, when she finally became prime minister, she revealed this kind of iron lady, this woman of determination and power. It was always there. And I don't think she was ever a great ideologue, either before or after she became a prime minister. She, I think, was much more pragmatic than people give her credit
for. You make the point that she'd sometimes listen to an argument and basically nod approval and slightly change her view.
Yeah, slightly. And I think, so for me, the kind of politician she was is that she did have some core principles and beliefs, and they were there consistently. But when she faced a great crisis, a great political challenge, it wasn't always completely clear which way she would jump. The first time she confronted the miners in this country, the National Union of Mine Workers, she backed off. The second time she took them on. She changed her attitude to Irish politics. The Falklands War was her great challenge, and she agonized, but once she was in, she was all in. And you know, that is a quality in politics that's not necessarily that common. A lot of politicians struggle to make up their minds. She was one of the ones who struggled to make up her mind. But when she did, she was willing to fight these all or nothing battles. And she was lucky in that she won them all until the last one that she lost, which was the fight about the poll tax in this country. She finally took on one fight too many. But for most of the time, once she'd made her choice and stuck to it, she came out the other side.
Talking to David Runciman, now writing about these different leaders, you employ an interesting metaphor, perhaps two metaphors to describe what you're up to, barium dye and acid. Let's talk first about barium dye.
Yeah, so one of the things I say about this book, and again, it comes from Caro. So Caro's biography of Johnson, it seems like it's the biography of a man, of a person, a character, and it is. But actually, it's really a great biography of America's political institutions, because what you do with Johnson is when you see what kind of man he is, what he's capable of, for better and for worse, you follow him through the corridors of power, like with an x-ray where a dye takes you through the human body so you can see what's going on, where the blockages are, maybe where the cancers are, what's working and what's not working. And I think when you see a political character and a really skilled biographer like Caro takes you inside the institutions, you don't see inside the person, but you see inside the politics of power. And that Johnson does that, and he comes up against various barriers and he finds ways around them. But acid is different. I mean, now with Trump, we're in the age of acid. I think if you follow Trump into the White House, you don't see him bumping up against the barriers, the corridors of power. You don't see him reaching the limit of his power and finding a way around it. He just burns through it. I mean, his strategy is just crash and burn. And we're seeing a bit of that with Boris Johnson here. And it feels like a different politics. It feels like what we're learning with Trump is not where the limits of power are, but what survives when acid is poured all over it. And I still think we don't know actually what survives. We don't know what will be left when Trump is gone. When Johnson was gone, we had a shape for the presidency. When Trump is gone, we don't know. There may be a hole there.
You know, I suddenly recall our first conversation a couple of years ago. You were making the point that American voters felt safe in making a protest vote, through, you know, via Trump, because they believed in the substantial or the enduring strength of their institutions. In retrospect, do you still think that was correct?
So I still think that probably does explain the vote. Were they correct to make that judgment? I think it's increasingly looking like that was a very, very risky bet. I also, at the time, made the analogy with Brexit. And I think with the Brexit vote too, one of the reasons that people felt confident to take this rather risky decision was the feeling that the institutions of British political life would shape it in a coherent way so that it was manageable. And again, I think we're just in the last few months really starting to reach the point where that may not be true. And rather than the institutions managing the bet is unraveling the institutions. The impeachment of Trump will be a test case of this. And if he sails through that and sails into another election, effectively untouched by the institutions, who knows whether the people who voted for him will think again. But I think we can say with hindsight that if that was the reason for taking a chance on Trump, that it couldn't get that bad because the institutions would constrain him, that may not be true second time round.
I've had dealings with any number of Australian prime ministers over the decades, and almost universally, they, when they've reached their goal, and many of them always felt they were destined to be prime minister, they'd find that the power they'd believed they'd get was an illusion, that they'd face all sorts of obstructions. And the big shock was that the prime ministerial power wasn't that powerful.
Yeah, and that's how I start my book, actually. I start it with the thought that this is true in the British and the American systems too. I mean, it's for different reasons. American presidents are stymied by the Constitution. British prime ministers are more stymied by some of the complex bureaucratic arrangements that surround the office. But I tell the story that Tony Blair's chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, told, that Blair arrived full of all these good intentions, a massive parliamentary majority, booming economy, opposition in disarray, the most popular prime minister of our lifetimes. After the death of Princess Diana, approval ratings through the roof, 90% plus, everything lined up, pulled the levers of power, nothing happened because they weren't connected to anything. And he discovered that you pull the lever, all of the instruments of political office that are meant to deliver on your will, it doesn't join up. If that was true for Blair, there's never been, I think, in the British case, a prime minister who came in such propitious circumstances. If he discovered it, everyone must discover it. As I say in the book, the question is, in a way, what people do next. I mean, what they decide then, the next move is, if you're Trump, you decide it's a conspiracy against you. If you're Blair, you decide to build your personal delivery unit that's going to act on your will, and that just creates more problems. If you're Clinton, you think you're going to think your way through it. I mean, they all have different responses, but they all have that experience.
But they all have to blame an outside force, whether it's the deep state or Sir Humphrey.
Yeah. So in Blair's case, he didn't really have an outside force to blame in his first term. I mean, the force that he should have blamed, and I write about this, is Gordon Brown. I mean, in a way, with hindsight, it's obvious what was going on, because the other thing that happens in politics is, just because you reach the top job doesn't mean your rivals who want the top job are going to give you an easy ride. They're going to make it harder for you. But Blair couldn't name his enemy, which was right inside his camp. So he had to pretend, or believe maybe in his own mind, that it was not the deep state, but Sir Humphrey, but a bureaucratic, hidebound civil service, and he needed go-getters around him. He needed personal advisors. He needed people who'd get things done. But nothing in the end really did get done until 9/11, and then things did get done, because when you go to war, people do what you say, but that's a completely different kind of politics.
David, what about your incumbent Prime Minister Boris, who's often compared to Trump, barium dye or acid?
That seems to me the question that we're dealing with now. I'm sitting in a studio in Cambridge. As I was sitting outside, on the screen was his speech to the Conservative Party conference, his first as Prime Minister. I was reading the text underneath. He just got to the point where he was talking about the divisions in his family when I came in here. And it is interesting, actually, that in the last 6 weeks, when he's been under enormous pressure and faced hostility and terrible political reverses, defeats in Parliament, defeat in the Supreme Court, at this point, no obvious successes in Europe. The only thing that has really shaken him is his brother resigning from his government. We sometimes forget that family ties often go way, way deeper than political conflicts. But the other thing with Johnson, I think is in his own mind, he came into office just a few weeks ago, not sure whether he wanted to be Thatcher or wanted to be Trump. Thatcher is barium dye, Trump is acid. At the moment, it tilts towards acid. At the moment, he's not bumping up against the limits and finding a way to accommodate his views to what he's allowed to do. He's testing those limits to destruction. And the next 2 or 3 weeks is going to push it even further, because it may be that he's going to break the law again.
Your book tends to reveal the best type of personalities to deal with power. Can you simplify that for us?
Yeah, I think all politicians within their personalities have advantages and disadvantages. There's no sort of perfect template. So even with Johnson, the man with whom I start, and we haven't had the completion of Caro's epic biography yet, and the last part of it, if and when it comes, which will tell the story of the Vietnam War, will show how that personality, which was so well suited to the early years of his presidency and a domestic agenda, that same personality was catastrophic when it came to foreign policy and the Vietnam War. And I think with all of these politicians, you see that the best of them and the worst of them always goes together. But it does look to me like the ones who come in with a prior sense of some of the limitations of the role, and that would be true of Thatcher. I don't think Thatcher was anything like Blair, coming in thinking she just had to click her fingers and it would happen. I think she thought it was going to be really, really hard work, and it was. A sense of the limits of the office, some self-awareness. I don't think Thatcher had much, but she had some. She maybe even had more than Blair as well on that front. And then luck. I mean, you can't tell the story of any successful prime minister or unsuccessful prime minister or president without seeing how hugely contingent it is. I don't know what Johnson, Boris Johnson, not Lyndon Johnson's story is going to be, because the next 2 or 3 weeks are so contingent, and some of it will play out through principles and political ideas and institutions clashing, and some of it will just be dumb luck. And his story will be one or the other, not just depending on his personality.
David, thank you for that. David is Professor of Politics at Cambridge University, host of the popular podcast Talking Politics, and the new Runciman is called Where Power Stops: The Making and Unmaking of Presidents and Prime Ministers, and it's published by Profile Books.